one of anybody in person. The world has become too Zoomified. Okay. So we had been learning Orach HaTzaddikim. We learned the beginning of it. And oh, it's my brother. Hi, brother. You're on mute. You're on mute.
Yeah, sorry about the power user thing. It's a it's a computer glitch that I gotta figure out. I log in one way versus the other way. It's not meant in any egotistical sense.
No problem. Very good. Welcome. This is my older brother Shmuel. Okay.
Small.
No, it's these days things are smaller. There were people in person last time, but now nobody's in person. I think because it's so much longer after Myriv now. Okay, so we were looking at the Orach HaTzaddikim, which, as I mentioned, is a book of Musar in a sense, not really from what we would call the classic Musar movement. It's really from about in the 1500s. But it certainly is Musar. It quotes a lot from the Rambam. You can see it in what he writes, but it also quotes really from Sefer Hasidim. You know, the Orach HaTzaddikim has a whole section that he lifts from the Rambam about how to do tshuva. And he also has a long section in tshuva that he lifts from Hasidei Ashkenaz about what to do if you sin. How long should you fast if you speak Lashon Hara? Usually it's 40 days for most sins. Also things like rolling in the snow and other things. We call all of that Tshuvas HaMishkal. That there's this idea from Sefer Chassidim that in the Rokeach, that a person in order to do tshuva has to not just change their ways, not just say vidoy like the Rambam says, not just make it up to people, but also has to suffer in a direct measure to the pleasure that they gained from the sin. There's a whole calculus in Sefer Chassidim and quoted a great deal by the Orach HaTzaddikim on how to do that. I'm not going to focus mostly on that, really focusing just on his introduction. And we talked a little bit about his idea that before the creation of the world, that there were seven things that were created. Torah, Tshuva, Gan Eden, Gehenem, Kisei HaKavod, Beis HaMikdash, Shmo Shel Mashiach. And all of these, he ties into the concept of Tshuva, that you need the Torah. I'm just summarizing from last time. You need the Torah in order, you know, to know what to do. You need Tshuva because nobody is perfect. Gan Eden and Gehenem you need because there has to be a sense of reward and punishment. There has to be, and we talked a lot in detail about what that means. Why does there have to be a sense of reward and punishment? What does it mean for there to be a teleology with regard to what we do? I've talked a little bit about Kisei HaKavod. We're not talking about Beis Mikdash and Shmo Shel Mashiach. Beis Mikdash in the name of the Messiah. And he writes, I think we're up to page 2. Kevan Shehikdim Kol Elu. He lists Kisei HaKavod along with Gan Eden and Gehenem, that these are way parts of reward and punishment. It says, Kevan Shehikdim Kol Elu, since God created all of these five things so far, so he argues here that you also have to have the Beis HaMikdash and the name of the Mashiach. I guess name here probably means either that it's a specific person or maybe it's the idea of Mashiach. You have to have those. Why? Because at that time, in the time of the Mashiach, the world will be filled with, as it says in the Navi, Kol Aretz. And the whole world will be filled with the knowledge of God, like the water that covers the earth. And there'll be a sense, this is the idea in Kabbalah, that God is hidden right now. The world is Olam, Helim, it's a place where God is hidden, but that in the future times, the divine will be revealed. And interesting question whether that's a good thing or not. I did have a Rebbe in high school, it's Scranton, who said, how can you pray for the Mashiach? You know, if the Mashiach is going to come, we're not going to be Yetzirah anymore. So who needs that? Who needs the Torah? It's nothing to do. So it's an interesting question here. If we say, Mali Kalar, it's Deus Hashem, the whole world's going to be filled with the knowledge of God, does that mean there's no Yetzirah? Could he still sin even if God is kind of revealed? I mean, probably we see from the Jewish people, certainly in the desert, that really, even if God is revealed, still one probably could sin. It's an interesting question. So he writes, "Avelo yeh yetzahara b'vnei Adam." Here he says, there won't be a yetzahara. There won't be an evil inclination. And which Ben do we have with us? Could be a lot of Bens. V'lo yeh yetzahara b'vnei Adam. There won't be a yetzahara. V'kulam yedu she'ikar b'riyas ha'olam b'shvil avodas avar yisrael. And everybody will know that the purpose of the world is to serve God. That's what it means, that the world be filled with God's knowledge. And that's why these seven things have to be before the world, even the Beit HaMikdash and the name of the Mashiach, because the Beit HaMikdash, I guess, here means the rebuilding of the Beit HaMikdash. And the Mashiach is the idea that you will go from tshuva, right, to reward and punishment. It's all these things that guide us through life to the goal, which is the revelation of God. So I wrote down some questions here. Since the world will be more spiritual and perfect, when the Mashiach comes, so it seems like we need that. In other words, he includes that among the seven. This is all about tshuva. Remember, this is in his section about tshuva. So we understand how Torah gives us a sense of what to do. Tshuva is how to, is the fact that we are human beings. And then we have reward and punishment. And then we have the Messianic era. Those really summarize seven things. And why is the Messianic era important? Why is that sense of goal important? So it seems like he has a need here for an endpoint. That it wouldn't kind of be enough. Why wouldn't it be enough without Mashiach? I mean, what if we just had Torah and Tshuva and reward and punishment? And how is it different than Gan Eden and Gehinom? In other words, is the Emot Mashiach, I guess it's a later point. But why do we need that? Because why do we need Ganed? Why do we need Gay? Why do we need Mashiach, Shmoshal Mashiach and the Beit HaMikdash, the ultimate? Why do we need the notion of redemption to be created before the world? That had been our discussion about the first five things. Why they need to exist before the world? Rather, a prerequisite to human beings. Can't have human beings without having tshuva, because humans are always going to be fallible. Can't have human beings without Torah, because there has to be a sense of purpose. You need reward and punishment, or else there's really no reason why. But why the Messianic era? That's really what Shmoshel Mashiach and Beit HaMikdash is. It's the Messianic era. Why do you need that to be created before the world? Because why is that such a prerequisite? I'm not sure.
It's maybe the ultimate reward and punishment, right? So just like...
You mean it's part of... It's sort of, it's really Torah and then Tshuva and then the next five things, Gan Eden, Gehinom, Kisei HaKavod, Shmoshel Mashiach, and Beit HaMikdash are all sort of one category, I mean.
Or related, at least. I mean, but also you could think of it, you know, if history is teleological, then the end of history has to be created in some sense before the world is created.
In other words, it's like reward and punishment. I see what you're saying. In other words, Gehinom and Gan Eden are a personal teleology, personal endpoint, whereas Shmoshel Mashiach and Beit HaMikdash you also need a national or a universal endpoint. Right? The endpoint is what creates a sense of being for, of purpose. That makes sense. Yeah. That's what that could be. Okay. And then he writes, V'yesh arba devarim b'nyanei yetshuva. There are four things with regards to a rishon, a shav, mechuzak, akirato et elokav. The first, really what he means is four ways of doing tshuva. It's a way of doing tshuva, which is a person recognizes God. A person has like a relationship with God. V'hukamo eved habarech me'adonav. It's like a servant that runs away from his master. He knows the master's there, and he wants to return to the master. When he thinks about the goodness the master's done for him, maybe for us, a better comparison would be a parent. He wants to ask for forgiveness. He wants to reinstate the relationship. That's the number one way. If the Jewish people return, they'll return to me. This has nothing to do, he says, with punishment. It's not about punishment. It's shuvah elai v'shuvah lechem. It's a sense of relationship here. We miss God. As the Chassidim always say that, you know, it's in the absence of God. It's in the darkness. That's where a person has the greatest sense of the divine. Sheni, if I guess that's the number one way to do shuvah. If that doesn't work, sheshav machem seishlo mochichim ha-machlimam oto ad shiyashuv. He repents because there are those that shame him, that rebuke him. In the eyes of others, he feels he needs to do tshuva. And this is like somebody runs away from their master and another servant comes and gives him rebuke that he left his master and recommends that he return. And the master waits until he returns to forgive him and he returns. And there's a sense of submission. So that's interesting. Shavila v'nichna. Right? There's a sense of submission about that. It's different than the first way. But the first way, he doesn't list this concept of submission. If you return because you've run away from the master and you miss the master or the parent and you miss the parent, because you appreciate them, so it sounds like that does not have to come with a sense of submission, of downtrodden, of smallness. Whereas if you've run away because you've rebelled, and then somebody else says to you, you know, look what the master did for you, you should return, you do. So there's a sense of shame, I guess, submission. Nichna means to bow, to cower, to bend over. That's interesting. It's a very psychological idea. A lot of the later Musar, the early Musar is not so psychological, as I mentioned. It's much more biting. The later Musar tends to be much more psychological, but here you do see some of that. That how we do tshuva is going to condition sort of our own personal response, our own emotional response. If we do tshuva because we love God, do tshuva because we recognize the goodness God has done, so that we can still sort of retain our own sense of self. Whereas if we've run away and somebody else has to rebuke us into repenting, sense of submission. Obviously, the third one he says, which is lower, is fear of punishment. And then the fourth one is that he actually, bad things happen. And it's like the servant who ran away and, you know, robbers accost him. And it's because he's run away and he's sort of gotten himself into this bad situation and he returns. So I guess the fear of punishment is a slightly higher level than actually being punished. It's funny because, you know, the Ramban says that the main idea of prayer comes from a place of pain. That the real chiyuv of prayer, real obligation of prayer, is when mimamakim kratif Hashem, when I cry out to God from the depths, from pain. And might even think that's a higher level. feel pain, right? I says that the fearing pain is a higher level than actually feeling the pain. I guess it makes sense. Because I guess
I've often felt there's some Hasidim who do too much chazanut is a form of tshuva samishkol.
Very good. Yeah. Yeah, I'm not gonna do it also. Okay. Yeda kochai shein derech leitzahara el derech asata. And everybody should know there's no way the evil inclination triumphs except through asata, seduction. Chila masito et mutter l'malitavato. At first, this is real musar. He tempts him with that which is permitted. It's an interesting question that we'll get into here, the question of asceticism. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? Right? I told you that he seems to draw on Sefer Chassidim, on the pietists of Germany, who were very much ascetics. And on the other hand, of course, we have Gemaras that we'll see in a minute that seem to contradict this, seems to think asceticism is a bad idea. He says here that the way the Yetzirah works, the way the evil inclination works, is first it tempts us with that which is permitted. And it trains us to just fulfill our desire. And after we become a glutton, and we become used to filling our desire with that which is permitted, so it sort of situates physical desire in us. It makes it very central for us, even though it's permitted, right? This is like the Ramban's idea that a person could be a manuvel birshuta Torah, that person could, if, in theory, you could just, you know, go to a Pesach program and eat everything you want. And, you know, whatever you could do. I don't mean to say that, but, you know, person, there's lots of things that are permitted. So you won't eat meat and milk. You won't eat angoja food, but person could be a glutton. And so the Torah says, Vasisa Yashrava Tov B'nei Hashem, do what is right and good in the eyes of God. And Ramban says that that's a sort of general category of menschlichkeit, of not just becoming a baltaiva, somebody who just is, you know, is in a permitted way, just fulfilling all of their desires. As Masito El Ha'isir HaKal, so then the Yetzihara brings us from that which is, I mean, he calls it forbidden here. It's hard to argue that it's forbidden, but maybe it is. That fulfilling our desires by that which is permitted, he thinks, is sort of lightly forbidden. And then it brings us from the light to that which is more strict, to that which is really forbidden. And he's a beheter lasot geder l'ma'ata times minimut. Therefore, he says, part of tshuva is stopping, is creating boundaries against actually that which is permitted. This is real sort of old school musar. Ba'azim yala b'libecha ha'isr. And then if you in your heart, you want that which is forbidden, zeh tanose kal v'chomer ba'atzma, you will say to yourself, kal v'chomer, muvta chosha t'parish mina hirhar v'choshke mina masa. So therefore, a person should forbid upon themselves things that are permitted, so that it becomes offense and you won't engage in that which is forbidden. And he thinks that fulfilling your desires in that which is permitted is always a slippery slope to the forbidden. So the obvious question would be, right, how do we put this together with things like I have the Gemara here. I don't think I quoted it, but we all know the famous Gemara that I don't know if we all know, but there is a well-known Gemara that why is it that a Nazirite brings a sacrifice at the end of his Nazirite-ness? There's an argument in the Talmud. One opinion is because he's leaving his state of asceticism of being a Nazir, and that's why he brings a sacrifice. But the other opinion is because he's forbidden upon himself wine, which the Torah permits us. And when you forbid something upon yourself that's actually permitted, that is sinful. And therefore the Nazir, the Nazirite, has to bring a sin offering at the end. We have other Gemaras like, we have Gemaras that are pro-asceticism, no question about it, but we have Gemaras like, on Rebbe's table, there was nothing missing, even cucumbers in the wintertime. Who could imagine having cucumbers in the wintertime? So that was like how rich Rebbe was, Rebbe Yehuda Hanasi, that he could even have that. And he didn't, and we see from that, the commentary say that he didn't stop himself from having it. He wasn't an ascetic. So that's an interesting question in Judaism generally. Here he's arguing certainly that asceticism is an important fence around that which is permitted. Does that work for us? Does that the idea of Mekadesh Atzmecha b'Mutar Lach, right? It says in Perkei Avos, sanctify yourself even around that which is permitted. So I don't know. I don't know if that works or not. I imagine it probably does work. Asceticism probably is a good way to create boundaries. On the other hand, often we say, right, Judaism is not ascetic. He does say the other side of it a little bit. He says, don't fast too much, lest your heart become weak and it confuse you. And you'll lose out through that, because you won't study Torah. Because you get so weak. And you won't understand the Torah because you'd be too weak. So it does have a little bit of a other side to that. And then he says, don't stop yourself from enjoying that which is simchas mitzvah, and that which is joyous in mitzvah. I mean, the truth is that if you think about it, we all do this, right? As we eat much more on Shabbos than we do on a weekday. Eat much more in Yantif than we do on a weekday. And we know that. In other words, that's because on Shabbat, Simcha Shel Mitzvah, it's the joy of a mitzvah. It becomes, the mystics say that when you eat on Shabbat, you don't have to have any particular kavanah. When you eat on a weekday, it takes a certain kavanah to sanctify things. But on Shabbat, it just happens automatically because that's the joy of the mitzvah. Yishuv Einu B'kuchas Kana Gidei Tzahara B'yanizer Alav Penyimali Kol Ta'avata. But still, he says you should be wary of the yetzer hara, the evil inclination to overeat or to overindulge. And he says, your heart goes weak because you're not eating enough, so eat twice a day a little bit, but don't fill your stomach at once. If it's not enough to eat twice, he says, have a little bit of jam. Now, if you're feeling depressed, he seems to have an argument. He seems to think it's not a bad idea to eat. Have a little bit of it and it'll make your heart stronger. So he's being quite psychological here, right? In other words, first he says, don't indulge. Then he says, simcha shel mitzvah, if it's a mitzvah, it's okay. He says, but don't eat too much. Right? He goes back and forth. And then he says, and if you're, you know, if it upsets you, if you don't have enough, if you're weak, eat something sweet. And if you think you should fast a day or twice a week, fast for what you need. Because the person who needs to fast and fast is called holy. As long as it doesn't take away from Torah. So that's interesting, right? Is he where is he at here? In other words, on the one hand, he seems to think you should sanctify yourself. On the other hand, he seems to want to play it both ways. He doesn't want you to do too much, get too weak. He doesn't want you to take away simchas mitzvah, the joy of mitzvah. On the other hand, he's worried maybe it'll really take its toll on you. You'll be too ascetic. It's funny, when you compare this to what he writes later in the book about how to do tshuva, you know, where you're basically fasting 40 days for every sin, and rolling in the snow, it's like this seems very tame compared to that.
Well, I once rolled in the snow after a hot tub at a ski resort, and it was actually rather pleasant.
Yeah, well, that's a little different.
I somehow don't think that the Scandinavian experience is quite what he had in mind.
I doubt it.
By the way, the Gemara that perhaps you were referring to, There's a Gemara in the Dorim, Daf Tesomet Aleph, is a Mishnah actually, which starts out Nidre Rishoyim. And I vaguely, from a long time ago, seem to remember there was some Mefarshim that said why they call it Nidre Rishoyim, because, you know, that's why you do the Korban, because you're depriving yourself Mimutalah.
In order to do Tshuva.
No, I don't think that's necessarily talking about Tshuva or not. Just the idea of the why a Nazir brings a Korban.
Ah.
I think it's on that those words.
I mean, the Rasha part is that he is being an ascetic. He's
yeah. It yeah. says, Nidre, Minidre Rishoyim Nazir.
I think this is in the Gemara in Brachos also that says, maybe not.
I think it's just taken as a remez, that's all.
Yeah, no, it's definitely my focus on the Gemara. So then he writes about Tshuvas HaMishkol, which is this concept that I mentioned from Chassid Ashkenaz of Tshuva that's done through pain. So what's Tshuvas HaMishkol? Kfi HaNoshen Emin Avera, whatever pleasure you had from the sin, you should create pain for yourself through fasting that will be equal and opposite, that will be equal to that pain, to be equal to the pleasure. Inin ha mishkav of inin kohanosimite. And he should minimize all pleasure. So that's one kind of tshuva, tshuva's a mishkal. And he has a lot of details for it. I didn't quote everything. And then there's a second kind of tshuva. There's really a few kinds of tshuva that are talked about in Jewish history. But here's another one, tshuva's hakasuv. Ketzad. So tshuva's hakasuv means to afflict yourself in a way that fits with the Torah's punishment. In other words, if the Torah's punishment for certain things is lashes, so maybe you should give yourself lashes. And we even have we have something reminiscent of this, which is a custom that some people have. I think it's even in the art scroll Siddur, to Erev Yom Kippur to take a leather belt and lightly beat themselves 39 times in case they deserve the 39 lashes in the time of the Sanhedrin. So I don't, I'm guessing that originally comes from the concept of tshuva's hakasuv, that originally that was the concept of beating yourself because that's what the Torah commands, even though we don't have a Sanhedrin anymore. But then it became really symbolic over time, in more recent years. So he writes here, tshuva's hakasuv ketzad, bol anida v'yesh bol zakares. If you do something that deserves karet, cutting off, or you do something that deserves death at the hands of Beit Din, of a death at the capital punishment, so you should give yourself pain according to what it writes in the Torah. In other words, if the punishment is being cut off from the Jewish people, or if the punishment is death, you should give yourself pain according in that measure. Now, obviously, you're not supposed to kill yourself. God forbid, that would be forbidden. In a rokeach kativ, so how do you do this? Ech yas etzar la'atzma kamaris. So the rokeach, Rabbi Elazar rokeach of worms, was really one of the main rabbis of Chassidi Ashkenaz, of the pietists of Germany, who lived in the 12th century. He says, how do you make pain for yourself for sins or for many sins? And we see in the Gemara that concept of fasting, even for very light sin, even if you did something by act, even if you did something just through speech. As it says, Beit Shammai says, I am embarrassed of my words. And he sat fasting until his teeth turned black. And the story of Rav Chista, I don't need you. And for that slight, he fasted many times. And so one of these is, so it doesn't matter, you see, whether it's between us and God or between us and other people, this concept of tshuva sakasuv, of doing tshuva the way the Torah wanted to inflict pain upon us, punishment on us. Now, it's interesting, right? You might think that punishment, right? There's a lot of argument in law. What's the function of punishment? Is it to stop people from doing things bad? right? We call that what's it called? Right? If the punishment for doing something wrong is in order to stop other people from doing it, that's a certain kind of punishment. That's called what's in English? And it holds people back from doing it. People won't do it because they know that there's a punishment. But it's not something deeper than that. Whereas there's another concept in punishment that maybe punishment, I think it's a concept in American also, is not just that. It's also kofar, that it's also to atone. Maybe it's not just to stop other people from doing bad things. Maybe there's a sense of deserving. Right? Why do we kill somebody if they've murdered? Do we do it to stop other people from murdering because that's such a bad punishment? Or we do it because somehow the person deserves to be killed because they killed?
Is the first example that you said about doing something so that people can see the adverse consequences, is that what happened with Slavkhod?
You mean
Kosher hates him?
Oh. I don't know. I mean, they don't know what to do, right? So they put him aside. It's an interesting question generally. Is the Torah...
Some say the Mekosha Shetzim was Slavkhod, and he did it in order to show other people that there's a punishment for doing this.
That's interesting.
It's a bit of a stretch, but...
Yeah. I mean, I guess maybe the story of Pinchas and Zimri might be that, right? This plague is happening and the Jewish people...
But that's different. Pinchas wasn't doing something bad to show people the consequences of doing a bad thing. He was doing something that in that unique situation was not bad.
Right, but I'm saying Pinchas' punishment in the sense of Zimri is to stop the people from sinning with Benos Moab, no?
Okay.
Maybe. So that's one... I mean, there's different theories of corporal punishment, right? Is it in order to stop people from doing it? Or is it because somehow it's deeper than that? It's fundamental. There is, you deserve something. You know, somebody kills somebody else, they deserve to be killed. It's different.
To what extent do you think that the later poskim on Shubas HaMishkol might have been influenced by the Christian flagellants.
There's a body of literature about this. There's a few articles that I found that do argue that Hasidei Ashkenaz, who were living in Germany, you know, time of the Crusades, that they were impacted by Christian ideas. Because really, the idea, I mean, Shuvasak, so you do have a concept, obviously, of punishments in the Torah, but the concept of tshuva in the Torah is really to change your ways, right? When the people of Nineveh fast and put on sackcloth, what does it say in Sefer Yonah? It says God saw their change their ways. God saw ma'aseihem, their deeds. So the concept in the Torah is much more changing your ways. It's not so much, Torah has punishments, but it doesn't seem like tshuva. When the Torah talks about tshuva, it doesn't really seem to talk about punishments. It seems to talk more about changing one's ways. Right? The Rambam has this concept of apologizing to the person, of being mefayes, making the person whole, satisfying them. So it's an interesting question. Is this notion of one has to suffer in equal to the pleasure that they gained from the sin, is that Jewish or not? So some people argue that this really came from a Christian source. I guess, especially because it begins with Hasidei, it seems to begin with Hasidei Ashkenaz, who are living in a Christian world. You don't find it in the Rambam, right? In the Rambam, you don't have this at all. You have the four steps of tshuva. You have to apologize, you have to have verbal confession, and you have to change your ways. You don't have this kind of tradition, so it could be. And especially the concept of fasting for every sin, even just speech, you have to fast. And now he seems to bring a proof from the Gemara. So we'd have to ask ourselves, is that, you know, a general rule? Is that just sort of a minor idea? Shiva Bakamatani as Khimatino but David, we see it with David Shinastanka Shina Brah Kajman as Rishim Shana. God was lost from David for 22 years, and every day, Mori Demos, David cried, and he ate his bread in dipped in dirt. It says, Ki offer Kalech Machalti, it's obviously a Madrashic idea. He continues, says, "Im hurgal adaber beis haknesses." If you talk during davening in shul, and you make jokes in shul during davening, made shiyashuv. So if you come to do tshuva, yizar shal yadaber beis haknesses shum davar shachol. So this is a slightly different idea. This is not so much. This is a different idea, right? This is not tshuvas hamishkal or tshuvas hakasim. This is not tshuva of suffering to burn away the sin. Or the pleasure from the sin. Rather, this is going to the opposite extreme. This is saying, if you talk in shul, so be careful in, that you shouldn't talk in shul. And that if you're guilty of speaking lightheadedly in shul, joking in shul, so go to an extreme of not speaking anything chulin, not speaking anything foreign in shul, not speaking anything outside of prayer and study. Now, the truth is that's actually the halacha in the Shulchan Aruch, that you're not allowed to talk in shul except words of prayer and study. It's actually, you're not allowed to have sichas chulin, just a regular conversation in the sanctuary. So he says, do that, afila shelo b'shas tefillah, not even at a time of prayer. Yashu b'mar gadol v'yispal b'achna, and then you will pray with great trembling. And he says, fast 40 days. It doesn't have to be in a row. It could be. Muflag doesn't have to, could be intermittent fasting. V'yilakebetzina b'chol yom, and you should lash yourself, beat yourself, not publicly but privately every day. Says that's what one should do if they talk in shul. Obviously, part of this is not tshuvas hamishkal, right? Part of this is the idea of the Rambam, sort of if you're on one side of a certain characteristic, go to the opposite side. But then he does put in these other things that you would not find in the Rambam. You definitely would not find in the Rambam, you know, beat yourself or fast. You would find, go to the opposite extreme. If you took ribbis, if you stole or you took interest, give it back, ask for forgiveness, right? That's where the Rambam would end, right? Don't do it again. But then he adds, and again, he's a combination of both, fast for 40 days or more, confess every day, careful, and then go to the opposite extreme. Don't take anything, not even a pledge. Don't borrow any money. Do a lot of gemilat chesed, give away money. So he's really a combination kind of tshuva ideas that we might have in halacha, but also mixed in with pietistic ideas. Okay, then he has a bunch of different things here. How to do different kinds of tshuvas hamishkal. Okay, I want to look at something different. I want to finish with something very different, which is a different kind of mussar, right? This is mussar from the 1500s. And so we see it's fairly biting mussar. It's fairly difficult, tough mussar. That's sort of the classic mussar that we're used to. I remember when I was in high school, I had a mussar chavrusa who was older than me, and we learned Orcha Tzadikim that year together. And I remember when we got to this perek, thinking, like, every sin I should fast for 40 days, I'll never eat. You know, like the amount of sins, you know, he must think that people don't do a lot of sins. You know, the amount of sins that probably the average person does. Fast for 40 days for every sin, you know, it's really... Really, that would be your whole life's work. Maybe I think people change over time. Okay. So this is the Ali Shor. Ali Shor is a Revelba, and is read these days. He was, I think he was the Mashkiach of the Mir Yeshiva. And I think that he was a student of Ruchem Lubavitz, who was a very famous Baal Musar. And this will be a kind of a different kind of Musar. This is hundreds of years later, of course. This is, you know, 400 years later. And one of the things that I've talked about is that Musar changes over time. It goes from the earlier Musar, Orchot Tzadikim, Mesilat Yesharim, those kinds of Musar. And then when you get to later Musar, like the Altar of Slobodka, which we'll do a piece next time from, or Rav Elba, the Ali Shor, we see a Musar that is not so much about the degradation of the human being, but the opposite, about the greatness of the human being. And that creates a different sense of how to do tshuva. So he says that tshuva ain't an inyan she'adam yochal hastig ba'ofen arai. He says you can't just do tshuva in a temporary way. You can't do it in one day on Yom Kippur. He says it's an avoda. It's an engagement with a certain kind of being, with a certain kind of being a human being. L'mitzvah shebalev ain't an assumed zman. He says when it comes to mitzvahs that depend on the heart, there's not a specific time. It's not that you might think from the Rambam that go through these steps and you'll have done tshuva. Confess your sin publicly, ask for forgiveness from the person, ensure in your heart that you won't do it again. That's it. Those are the steps of tshuva. So he says here it's more than that. Tshuva is not just, there's different kinds of mitzvahs. There's mitzvahs that we do in action, and there's mitzvahs of the heart, right? Like what might be called classically mitzvot shemiyot mil sichliyot. Shenid malanu kilu memeleh mitkaimot. And we sometimes think that mitzvahs of the heart just kind of happen on their own. Avlu kol gadol baruchnius, he says, but it's a general rule in spirituality that shum davar lo nasim memeleh, nothing happens on its own. The davar shelo nakdish davar le'ilanu. He says you can't just, you know, when it comes to believing in God or we just assume that's a kind of background radiation to faith, you know, that I believe in God or that I trust in God or that I can do, you know, that I feel bad for what I do wrong. He says, don't treat it that way. Don't see it as just a kind of, you know, background sensibility. He says, you have to put it front and center. It has to be proactive. Lo shafar chalkan shel ha-mitzvos shebelev lumas ha-mitzvos ha-masios. It's not different than an active mitzvah. Ma'isa mugdar anachnu muchrachim l'tedazman ha-kavua lehen. We have to set aside time, specific time, to do even a mitzvah in the heart. And then it can get done well. The rabbis, he says, never just left things to our hearts. It has to be translated into action. For instance, getting rid of chametz, right? We get rid of chametz partly by being mevatel chametz, by nullifying chametz. But you can't just leave it up to a person's heart to nullify chametz. Rather, the rabbis created a process for it. Because it's dependent on our thoughts and on our hearts, we need action. And so we have a whole process of nullifying chametz. We search for it. We nullify it in language. You know, tshuva hi mitzvot liya legamri blev. It says tshuva is totally heart-oriented. Now, that's very interesting, right? Because if you read the Rambam's Book of Halacha, you would think it's not just heart-oriented. You would think that tshuva is a set of actions. He's saying it's much more than that. He's saying that tshuva really is emotional. Tshuva mitzvot liya legamri blev. Chazal lo matzu lo eza maisa sheyavtich et kiyuma. And the rabbis did not find an action to ensure the doing of tshuva. Yom HaKippur shalanu. Yom HaKippur is what Yom Kippur is what does it. V'li avodas kohen gadol v'li hashir sar la'azazel. What's left when you take away the service of Yom Kippur and the scapegoat of Yom Kippur? It's all in the heart. It's a very interesting idea. There's no act on Yom Kippur, right? We have prayer. Prayer is pretty late in Judaism. I mean, it's funny because people think Yom Kippur is the most constructed day there is, but it's actually the least constructed day. There's no symbol. It's not like Rosh Hashanah where you blow the shofar. What's Yom Kippur? You know, Yom Kippur is just prayer. I mean, what about before prayer? So you have the sacrifices, but without the sacrifices, if Chazal had an instituted prayer, what would Yom Kippur be? It would just totally be in the heart. Yes, libeinu anachnu tzrichim lahichin likvata. But so we have a dilemma. We have a mitzvah to do in our heart, basically. But how are we going to do it? I mean, with no structure, it's very hard. Ma niflaim divrei Maran hagon Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. That which Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, great Musar master, said. B'chol igurotav, that he writes in all of his letters about Yom Kippur. We would have no idea to do tshuva, he says, without the instruction of Sol Salanter. And we should learn during Elul that which he wrote it's written down, and there's a book of Sol Salanter's works and his letters. And part of it is the following. Yom Kippur, Dover Tov Lamod. Yom Kippur is a very good thing. Yom Slicha V'Kapara, day of forgiveness and atonement. The Mishnah says there was no day as good as Yom Kippur. It's nothing better than it. Yom Kippur is machaper, it atones if we get rid of our sin, if we let go of our sin. And even a little bit of Yom Kippur, he says, is a good thing. He says, a little bit of Yom Kippur, a little bit of tshuva, a little bit of letting go of our sin and engaging in Yom Kippur, it's more valuable than anything we can imagine in the world. And Lirot b'Yom Kippur sh'tia is a Kabbalah above Yom Kippur, that on Yom Kippur we should think about the future, right? The human being analyzing their past and thinking about how to change their future, that's the key to Yom Kippur. Ve'ein lanu mischar nosei pri revach, k'molas is a chana b'libana musar. He says, if you learn musar, that's going to really help. That will help us change our way for the future. I mean, it's really an amazing thing that programmed into the Jewish calendar is everything, right? Freedom, intense joy. And Yom Kippur, if it wasn't programmed into the calendar, we just wouldn't do it. The idea of, thinking about, it's so hard. I mean, how do you change yourself? How do you change what you do? We talk about it, we think about it every Yom Kippur, but it almost seems impossible, right? I mean, on Yom Kippur itself, if you say to a person, are you changing your ways? They are. But then human beings, it's very hard to change. You know, a few weeks later, I don't know. I think for most people, are we really different, you know? On the other hand, maybe we are different. You know, maybe if we didn't go through Yom Kippur, we wouldn't be the same, even if we slide back. Everything that a person, even a little thing a person does in Yom Kippur, to increase the concept of their Yom Kippur Shalom, right? Each person's Yom Kippur is personal. It feels very communal, but it's really personal. We can't imagine how it changes us. Yef Shalotarit go to Lahevdel. We can't measure the difference, how much a difference it makes. It does make a big difference. In the future world, it changes us. So he says, we really can't do Yom Kippur without time set aside for thought. And he says, do it twice a week during Elul. It says, take an hour twice a week during Elul. Misharosham bidvarim hanogim elav v'pinkas meshachal shana. He says, if you're the kind of person who's written down your deeds in a book all year, this was a concept among Musar masters, among Musar teachers. They would encourage people to keep a little book with them to write down their sins and to write down things they want to change. Yakalo lasot cheshbon nafshu b'mei tshuva. So if you do that the whole rest of the year, it makes it much easier during the time of tshuva. Yeah, Pinkas Yashala Ma Nichshal Ma Rotzin Sal, because this book will remind you what you want to change. So, maybe we're not on the level where we could do that all year, all we'd be doing is writing. But maybe during Elul, an interesting idea to write something down. And the Rambam has the concept of vidui dvarim, of confession, that saying it is important, right? The Rambam, it's very interesting, very few things you actually have to say. In fact, the Rambam holds even a bracha said in the mind is enough, but confession has to be said out loud. And there's a psychological side to that. And to write something down is a very interesting idea, right? I mean, we encourage this a lot in the regular world, you know, whether it's around, you know, for journaling or, you know, New Year's resolutions. But when one writes something down, it makes a roshim, it makes a big impact on us. You know, it makes it very concrete. I remember when I was a kid, I once hit my brother, John, by accident, had some kind of stick or something. I was like, I don't know, 10 and he was 20. And my father wanted me to apologize. I didn't want to apologize. And he said, you know, if you can't admit your sin, there's no tshuva. You can't do tshuva unless you're willing to say what it is. That's to say it, to write it, is to make it real, right? Because the things that we're lacking, we push aside because generally we're probably good people. You know, or if we're not generally good people in our own mind, it just becomes an obsession. You know, we basically become, we think of ourselves as terrible all the time. And so it never becomes real. But to write it down or to say it, I mean, that's why for the Rambam, Vidoy Devarim, confession is so important. This is interesting. He says, some people work very hard during the month of Elul to find a good etrog. And it's Yom Kippur, and they're busy building a sukkah. And what they've done essentially is, he says it's, in the psychological terms, this is resistance. He says, what you're doing is you're using mitzvahs like esrog and lulav. Those are holy things. Those are good things. But person uses them to avoid Yom Kippur, to resist its resistance, to avoid Yom Kippur because Yom Kippur is scary because they don't want to come to terms with things to change, and so he says you have to be very careful of not getting too involved in building your sukkah before Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur is for Yom Kippur. Alein aliras beruos manach b'chayv masmei tshuva. He says the Rabbi Yisrael Salanter taught us Yeshno Yetzer Ruchani. There's a spiritual evil inclination that tries to steal away from us tshuva, steal away from us true service by getting us involved in mitzvahs. It's a very interesting idea. Right? In other words, I direct my spirituality toward finding the right esrog, so that I don't have to really engage with who I am as a human being spiritually. Fascinating idea. That's what Rabbi Salanter said. It's the spiritual yetzer hara, spiritual evil inclination for doing mitzvahs. Interesting idea. So these are all Musar ideas. You know, obviously, you have, again, just to summarize, sort of early Musar, where clearly there's a sense of structure from the Rambam, but there's also a whole world of, you know, beating ourselves and giving ourselves pain and, you know, trying to undo sin that way. But very different than later Musar, which really tries to make room for the heart, room for cheshbon hanefesh, for an accounting of the soul, which is really, right, it's inner introspection, and it's attunement and mindfulness. These are words that we use a lot today, but they're also old words for us. We just have a couple minutes left. Any questions? We sign off. I'm just trying to give a sort of sense of different Musar writers.
So this is a question,
yeah.
Not about the Musar, but about what we said with the Rambam and thinking blessings. Mm-hmm. So does anyone else hold that way?
I'm not sure. Not sure. I think it's a minority opinion. I think most people think you have to say a blessing, you have to say Shema. There are opinions that you could do it just in your heart. I think the Gemara might even mention it. I think it's mentioned in Brachos.
Yeah, because usually, especially Sephardim, will follow the Rambam. So it's easy.
Right. No, but I mean, even the Rambam thinks you should say it. The question is whether you fulfill your obligation.
Well, You could ask the there is a there's a Mishnah in Trumos that basically lists five people who can't bring truma, but if they do, they're yotzei, and one of them is someone who's mute, and the reason is because he can't say a bracha. So,
well, because over there, I think you have a declaration you have to say. Arami ovedavi. That you mean bikurim?
No, that's not bikurim. They're talking about truma, and the bracha is ala prashas trumas and maisos, or lahafish.
They can't bring truma.
So how can you? So if he can't,
if you eat matzah without the bracha, you're still yotze eating matzah.
Yes. But for some mitzvahs, you need to say a bracha, although Yaakov Kamenetsky has a commentary on it, actually on his coming week's parsha, where he argues it's not the bracha itself, it's rather the fact that you have to have a certain kind of kavana, and the bracha is megala on that kavana.
Simon or Steve.
Yeah, I was just learning that in right before your shiur. With a charus of mine, so that's why I know that. But there is this Mishnah that a cheresh, someone who can't speak, should not bring truma because he can't do the bracha.
That's interesting. The Gemara often assumes
the cheresh is yosei.
I think Gemara often assumes a cheresh can't do mitzvahs generally because we assume they're not a
sound. And not just a cheresh, also someone who is orum, who's naked. Because he can't, and Rashi says it's because, the Gemara says actually, it's because he can't say a bracha.
Oh, all right, so I have to look into this idea.
And yet, the truma is truma so truma. It works. So that would, I don't know whether that's a statement that, it seems like speaking, it does make a difference. But not necessarily 100% difference.
I mean, there are some things that have to be spoken. Like, I think chalitza.
Yeah, well, the kurum, yeah, for sure.
Yeah. All right. Wish everybody a good week. There'll be one more class on Musar and Tshuva, and then have a good week.
Thank you very much.
Good night.
Good night.